This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Robert Redford, is not just the star of the movie All Is Lost, he's the only character. He gives what the New York Times film critic A.O. Scott describes as the performance of a lifetime, and the New York Film Critics Circle recently voted him Best Actor of the Year for the film. He was also just nominated for a Golden Globe. Redford plays a man alone on a small yacht in the Indian Ocean. We don't know his name or anything about him, except what we can deduce by what we see. Early in the film, his yacht is rammed by a stray container that must have dropped off a container ship. It leaves a hole in the boat that begins a series of problems he has to overcome if he is to survive. Redford's best-known films include Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, The Candidate, The Way We Were, The Sting, All the President's Men, and Out of Africa. Terry spoke with Redford last Thursday and began with a clip from All Is Lost, the opening narration of Redford's character reading a letter he's writing. After the voiceover, the action switches to 8 days earlier.
13th of July, 4:50 p.m. I'm sorry. I know that means little at this point, but I am. I tried. I think you would all agree that I tried. To be true, to be strong, to be kind, to love, to be right. But I wasn't. And I know you knew this in each of your ways. And I am sorry. All is lost here, except for soul and body. That is what's left of them. And a half day's ration.
Robert Redford, welcome back to Fresh Air. That's such a stirring opening for the beginning of the film. You read that letter as if it were a poem. Can you talk about that?
Well,
a little
bit? I think I probably saw it that way. I probably felt it that way. There are some marvelous objectives in it. You know, I think everybody wants to be true and strong. And it's the right parts that's difficult. And I think that there's a kind of an arrow to the character around that when he says, and I tried to be right, although I failed. I think you can maybe imagine that that's where he fell short of what his objectives were.
Yes, well, we try to imagine when we watch the movie because it's not spelled out for us. Did you want to know your character's backstory, like who he's talking to? You assume it's family. You don't really know anything about who he's writing to, what his life has been like, why he's out in this yacht in the middle of the Indian Ocean. Did you have to know this yourself?
In the beginning, I thought I needed to ask questions to the director, J.C. Chandor. But frankly, Terry, I was very drawn to what you did not know. There were challenges in there that were very attractive to me. I liked the idea there were no special effects. It was a very low-budget film, very independent in its spirit and its budget. And because I felt that it was more of a pure cinematic experience the way films used to be, maybe even going back to silent films. High technology has kind of entered the film business, maybe infested the film business. But going to what you're saying, I think, yes, I did ask in the beginning, is there something I should know about this? And the director evaded answering it. And then I realized that this is what was intended. And so I went with that. I liked, yes, I could fill it in to a certain degree, but not too much beyond.
Give us a sense of some of the things that you had to endure, like when you're in the storm, in one of the storms, and you know, you're being rained on. What are you experiencing? How are you protecting yourself?
Well, it was a real storm because yes, as you said, a lot of it was on the open water. But when we had to get into the really tough stuff, we went into a giant tank where they have these big wave machines, these big cylinders that can cork up the waves to 6-7 feet that will swamp the boat or maybe turn it over. You had rain, violent rain machines, then you had wind machines, and you had crew members with fire hoses hitting you with water, heavy streams of water. So when all those things are cooking at once, you really are in a storm. So I really did feel while I was doing this that I was actually in a storm, and I had to feel like I needed to feel, like I'm really in a storm. What am I going to do? How am I going to? And it became very physical. I also went into this, I guess at my age, wondering what can I still do? I always, because I was in sports as a kid and, you know, was athletic pretty much my life, I wanted to. I always enjoyed doing my own stunts when I could. It was in a way a test. I said, well, let's see what I can do, you know, and I'll do what I can.
You know, in the credits roll, it says cast Robert Redford. And that's it. That's
it's
embarrassing. You are the cast. And then after that, there's this like long scroll of, you know, camera people and effects people and the people who dealt with the fishes and the people on the ships. And I'm thinking like this is like huge group of people working on the film. And you're like the only person ever on camera. That must have been such
when
an odd
when I saw
position.
That, you know, I've only seen the film once.
I'm surprised you saw it. Don't you sometimes not even see your films?
Sometimes, yes. Sometimes I've not seen. Yeah, some films I've not seen.
Yeah, but anyway,
that's a whole other story.
Yeah.
But anyway, when the first and only time I saw it was at the Cannes Film Festival, and so when the film, because you know they booth films there.
Yes.
And so when the lights came down, I'm thinking, geez, you know, this could go either way. And I'm sitting here in a tux. How embarrassing to be in a tuxedo and be booed, you know? So I'm sitting there thinking, God, I wonder how this is going to go. So then I saw on the screen, cast member, just me alone. And I thought, oh my, I'm really in trouble now if they boo this thing. Because they're going to be booing me, you know? Anyway, it went the other way. Happily, it went so much the other way. That in itself was a shock, a pleasant one.
You know, a couple of years ago, there was a biography of you written by Michael Feeney Callan. And I was reading that, and I was really surprised to learn that as a child you had polio. I mean, you're such a physical person. You're so athletic and so physically fit, and now even at the age of 77, you're so physically fit. You needed to be in order to do All Is Lost. And the thought of you being paralyzed for a while as a child was shocking to me.
Yeah, it was to me too.
Sure.
It wasn't a severe case. I think we should, you know, want to make sure we get this straight. It wasn't an iron lung case. It was a case of mild polio, but it was severe enough to put me in bed for 2 weeks. And because in those days, polio, before the Salk vaccine was discovered, what hung over your childhood was always the fear of polio because all you saw were people in iron lungs. So yeah, when I got it, it was because of an extreme exertion in the ocean, in this bright sunlight in the ocean. And, it was alarming, but it wasn't serious enough to go much further.
Were you paralyzed at all?
No, I was down. I couldn't move very well, but I was not paralyzed.
So, you said that you got the polio because of, overexerting yourself at sea?
Yeah, or I was just with another kid. Another kid and I were out on the ocean, and we had these little things they were called pedalos. And there were these little wooden kind of crates where they would float, but you would have the pedals inside, and you would pedal. And it would move the thing, but they were wide open. So I got carried away with this guy, and we were competing and going as fast as we could. And I got carried away and went way too far out, just pedaling my brains out. And I got so far out there, I thought, Jesus, where am I? Well, there's the mainland is way, way back there. So we turned around, came back in. But I had kind of done myself in. Exhaustion, heat, sun, stroke, everything.
So what message did you take away from that? Like I should never overexert myself again or?
That I would never get into a pedalo again. I don't think I went beyond that. Because I love the ocean. I love surfing. And as a kid, I loved to surf.
Your mother died when you were 18. She was sick. I'm not sure what she died of. How did that change the course of your life? Did you have to rewrite
your
plans? And
I don't know that it changed anything at the time. She was a wonderful person. She died very young. She was full of life, full of laughter, full of love. She was out there. I mean, she would take chances, and she was very risky. And she taught me how to drive a car when I was 10, and nobody knew about it. I mean, that kind of stuff. So we had a close relationship. But also, I was of a young mind, just like all the other kids my age were. you didn't want your parents around. You didn't want your parents doting on you. You didn't want attention or anything like that. And you had a mother that wanted to give you that attention, and you kind of pushed it away. I feel bad about that.
You went to college, and from what I've read, academics was not your thing so much, and that you did a lot of drinking and rode motorcycles.
Yes, drag races, the whole thing.
It sounded like an almost like rebel without a cause era. You know, you're breaking loose and everything, but sounds like there was no like social, political, spiritual, whatever, drug even, like context to put it in.
Well, there was alcohol. There was social. The sociability was tied mostly to alcohol in those days. And so, yeah, I certainly had my feel of that. But what was at the heart of all this, I think, was the fact that I was not a good student through my entire life. My mind was out the window. I drew underneath the desk. I drew pictures. I wasn't learning the way I was supposed to learn. And I think I realized that my education was going to happen when I got out in the world and engaged with other cultures and other places and other languages and had the adventure of exploration. I felt that's my education. So I left. Actually, I was asked to leave. So
why? Why were you asked to leave?
Because I was such a terrible student. My grades were terrible. And the interests I had were not anything that was going to amount to much of a career for me. You know, anthropology I loved. Psychology I loved, and geology I just really loved. So you put all those things together, what are you going to be in life? And anyway, I took off and earned some money in an oil field to earn enough money to last for a year in Europe, and I went there when I was 18 to be an artist, and that's when I began. I think that's when my education really began.
You did a lot of episodic TV early in your career in the early 1960s, Maverick, Rescue 8, The Deputy, Playhouse 90, Perry Mason, Naked City, The Twilight Zone.
Hey, now, Perry Mason, now look, do you know what the title of that? That was what, 1959? You know what the title of that was?
What?
The Case of the Treacherous Toupee. That was the name of it. How is that? And I was so excited to have a job. You know.
Who had the toupee? I can't remember now.
It wasn't Raymond Burr, but somebody did, some blonde kid. But those were your apprenticeship years, and it's always sort of one of the things that's sort of been weird is to see yourself characterized so often as somebody that looks well, that has glamorous looks or is appealing physically. That's nice. I mean, I'm not unhappy about that, but what I saw happening over time was that was getting the attention, and sometimes because I always felt that I was an actor, and that's how I started. I was a person who loved the idea of craft. I wanted to be good at my craft, and therefore I would be an actor that would play many different kinds of roles, which I did. I played killers, I played rapists, really deranged characters, but most people don't know about that because that was in television. So suddenly you're seeing yourself in kind of in a glamour category, and you're saying, well, wait a minute, you know. The notion is that, well, you're not so much of an actor. You're just somebody that looks well. And that was always hard for me because I always took pride in whatever role I was playing, I would be that character. Like, you know, if you look at, say, Jeremiah Johnson, you know, the character in The Wilderness. And within the same year I was doing The Candidate. And you know, you put those two together and you would hope that somebody would say, well, somebody's acting here.
So skipping ahead to 1969, you make Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid with Paul Newman. And this is the movie that makes you kind of iconic. Did you already know how to ride horses? Did you like Westerns when you were making this?
Yeah, I knew how to ride horses. I loved horses. I liked doing my own stunts when I could. When it first came up, because of the age difference between Paul and I, which was like 12, 13 years, and he was really well known. I was not well known. I had just done, I think, the film Barefoot in the Park. But he had a career, obviously, that was very high. And so the studio did not want me. The director, George Roy Hill, and I met in a bar on Third Avenue. And they were putting me up to play Butch Cassidy because I'd done this comedy on Broadway. So, nobody thinks very deep about stuff like that. They said, well, He did a comedy, Maybe You Should Go Up for Butch Cassidy. And so we're sitting in this bar, and I told him at the time, I said, yeah, I can do that, but that's not the part that interests me. I'm more interested in the Sundance Kid. I feel more comfortable in that role. And that surprised George, and then he got kind of sold on that idea, but the studio didn't want me. And I think it was Paul Newman and William Goldman, the writer, and George that stood up for me against the studio. But the one that really pushed it aside, of course, was Paul. And when I met Paul, he was very generous, and he said, I'll do it with Redford.
He was originally supposed to be the Sundance Kid, and you were supposed to be Butch Cassidy?
Yeah, that's right. The original title of the script was The Sundance Kid and Butch Cassidy. That was the original title that Goldman had written. And Newman was to play Sundance, but he had played that kind of part before. And George was the guy that saw Paul. He saw a side of Paul that many hadn't seen because he had worked with him in television, and he knew him personally. He says, no, this guy, he's very nervous. He talks a lot. He tells bad jokes. I think I see him as Butch Cassidy, and he saw me as Sundance. So he had to fight for that. So when it was finally done, then they changed the title to Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Would you mind if I played a scene?
Mm-mm.
Okay, so this is a kind of famous scene where, you know, you're both bank and train robbers, and at this point you're not exactly surrounded, but you're cornered. You're on a
ledge.
A ledge, yeah. And on top of you on this, you know, rocky ledge is the posse that's hunting you down. You've got no place to turn. You've got no place to go except for the water that's underneath, and that's you're up really, really high, and it's a very rocky. Yeah. River or stream. But anyways, as Butch Cassidy is trying to figure out what their options are, what you want to do is like shoot your way out. And so you speak first.
Ready?
No, we'll jump.
Like hell we will.
No, it'll be okay. If the water's deep enough, we don't get squished to death. They'll never follow us.
How do you know?
Would you make a jump like that and you didn't have to?
I have to, and I'm not gonna.
Well, we got to, otherwise we're dead. They're just going to have to go back down the same way they come. Come on.
Just one clear shot. That's all I want.
Come on. We got to.
Nope. Get away from me.
Why?
I want to fight them.
They'll kill us.
Maybe.
You want to die?
Do you?
All right. I'll jump first.
Nope.
Then you jump first.
No, I said.
What's the matter with you?
I can't swim.
Why, are you crazy? The fall will probably kill you.
How reassuring.
Yeah, right.
So that's my guest, Robert Redford, with Paul Newman from the 1969 film Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Were you surprised at how famous that scene became?
Yes, I was. I mean, that I was surprised at the whole thing. I remember when I saw the rough cut. I mean, I loved making the film. I had a lot of fun. I've never had so much fun on a film as I have that one. But when I saw the rough cut of it, I said, wait a minute, what's that song doing in it?
Oh, Raindrops Are Falling on My Head, the Burt Bacharach
song. Yeah, I said, wait
song.
A minute, what's that all about? I said, what in the hell? First of all, it's not raining. Secondly, what's that got to do with anything? I thought, well, that's they just killed the film. It made no sense to me. And, you know, how wrong can you be? I had listened to that song on the radio for 6 months. but the film also, Terry, another thing that's interesting about how, I guess the value of word of mouth. I remember when the film came out, George Roy Hill and William Goldman were very upset and depressed because the reviews were mixed to negative. And word of mouth is what made the film build. But when it first opened, it had these mixed reviews. I didn't read them. I remember they were very upset and depressed. And one of the reasons some of the reviews were negative was that the anachronism of the dialogue, like modern day talk then. I found that pretty inspiring and fun. It was just fun. But apparently that's what some of the negative response was. But it was, I guess, overridden by the acceptance of the whole film.
By the way, I had the same reaction about raindrops have fallen on my head in the middle of the film. I thought,
well, did you really?
Yeah. I mean, it made absolutely no sense to me.
It says you and me, then. There's two of us.
So not long after shooting Butch Cassidy, you co-founded a new organization called Education, Youth, and Recreation to promote alternative films on university campuses. And
it
was a big mistake. Why was it a big mistake?
Well, because at that time, I was already beginning to feel the urge to do something that would be maybe more supporting more independent type films. We thought, well, what if we buy up documentaries that were either not distributed or poorly distributed, and films that were the same, and went for the college market, went right to the colleges and say, okay, we're bringing this to you. Well, what we realized is that no one came, so it failed.
Did you lose money personally on that?
No. I didn't have my own money into it. But I suspect that over time, if I look back on it, that was probably
the genesis of what
later became CIA.
It's interesting that back in the late 60s, early 70s, you were already thinking in that direction.
Yeah, and it was different then because, you know, one of the beauties was that I was able to work in both within the mainstream. In those days, the studios would allow for smaller films to be made under their umbrella. So if I had, like, I wanted to tell stories about the America that I grew up in, and for me, I was not interested in the red, white, and blue part of America. I was interested in the gray part, that where complexity lies and where things get complicated. But in those days, you would do a larger film, but you would also be able to, if you did those films, you could say, well, would you allow me to make this smaller film? And they would do it. So The Candidate and Downhill Racer were done at Warner Brothers. At the same time, I would do a larger Warner Brothers film, like All the President's Men or what have you. So that carried through the 80s until the business changed. And suddenly, Hollywood became more centralized. It was following the youth market. Technology was creating more chances for special effects, which would be more of a draw for the youth. And so Hollywood, which basically Hollywood follows the money, that's what it does. And so it was going that direction. And it was beginning to leave behind those other kinds of films. And so there was this gap there. They weren't likely to be making those films anymore. They were going to be offloading that. That was what led to the idea of Sundance, first with the labs and then the festival. But if I look back on it and think back in time, it probably started way back then with that first venture that failed.
Thank you so much for coming back.
Thank you, Terry.
Yeah,
and your voice is a lot more pleasant than mine.
Oh, I wish.
No, it is. You have a beautiful voice.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah. I'll play that back in my mind.
Okay. Robert Redford spoke with Terry last Thursday. Redford stars in the new film, All Is Lost. To hear the full interview, visit our website, freshair.npr.org. In 1935, drummer Chick Webb was a Harlem bandleader looking to make a bigger impact on recordings, and singer Ella Fitzgerald was a homeless teenager who'd recently won an Apollo Theater talent contest. They were introduced, and she joined his band. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead tells us about a new box set that showcases their work together.
Chick Webb taking a too rare drum feature with his big band on Gershwin's Liza. Webb's outfit terrorized competitors in band battles and sent dancers into orbit at Harlem's Savoy Ballroom. On record, they were rarely that explosive. Early on, they did have some hot Edgar Sampson arrangements that Benny Goodman would soon turn into hits, like Blue Lou and Don't Be That Way. But the Webb band also had an old school crooner, Charles Linton, with pre-jazz age enunciation.
I drew a curtain around us, and the blossom with a dew with a gleam. Romance and happiness found us, and carried us off in a dream. Oh, moonlight.
Charles Linton helped draw a coitin over mannered singing like his when he brought scruffy 16-year-old Ella Fitzgerald to Chick Webb's attention. Her sound was streamlined and modern, about melody and rhythm more than emoting. Ella was unformed, but could read music and learn a song in a second. "This is it," Webb said. "I have a real singer now. That's what the public wants." Music publishers deluged the band with mostly forgettable mid-tempo swing tunes, but Ella could make something out of almost anything. Her articulation was always precise, but as in later years, a New York accent might slip out.
Oh, baby, I don't want any bright and yellow. You can have your sweet romance. Sing me a swing song and let me dance. Mr. Trombone, play some corn. I ain't caring what notes. Mr. Trumpet, grab a horn. Brother, give me hot notes. Oh, baby, I don't want any tune on a cello. Give the rhythm and a chance. Sing me a swing song and let me dance.
Contrary to press reports, Chick Webb never adopted Ella Fitzgerald, but there was some family feeling in the band, the belief that the success of one was good for all. Benny Goodman made some moves to steal her away, but Ella stayed put. She started writing a bit and had a hand in her mega hit, A Tisket a Tasket, one of the band's several adapted children's songs. The first song Fitzgerald co-wrote, You Showed Me the Way, could almost have been a love letter to Webb and the orchestra that gave her a home.
You showed me the way when I was someone in distress, a heart in search of happiness. You showed me the way. My skies were so gray. I never knew I'd feel a thrill. I couldn't dream a dream until you showed me the way.
Chick Webb suffered from tuberculosis of the spine and other ailments and died in a Baltimore hospital in 1939. His ultra-cool last words, "I'm sorry, but I gotta go." The orchestra continued under Ella's name, losing steam even as she matured. The last of their juvenile tunes, 1941's Melindy the Mouse, had a grown-up subtext. You can hear how Ella Fitzgerald's light touch showed the way to flip new band singers like Anita O'Day.
Melinda was a mousy living in a little housey, and her life was one of wonderful ease. On the sunny side of 20, with a papa who had plenty, her life was just a bowl of cheese. One day a kitty said, "My, but you're pretty, I love you." Mousy near died, but replied, "Why, I know nothing of you. You're just a kitty cat." But kitty.
This music's from a typically mammoth, lovingly annotated 8-CD box from Mosaic, the complete Chick Webb and Ella Fitzgerald Decca Sessions, 1934 to 1941. It actually warms up with a few earlier tracks. Various budget anthologies skim the vocal or instrumental cream from these four dozen sessions. The complete output shows how hits collections distort the historical record. When the old days look rosier to us, we're usually remembering the highlight reel. There are hidden gems here, but they ain't all gems. By 1941, Ella had ripened enough to go solo, and the orchestra folded. Before long, singers like Frank Sinatra were eclipsing big bands as popular attractions. Chick Webb and Ella Fitzgerald had already showed him the way.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure, Downbeat, and E-Music, and is the author of Why Jazz. He reviewed the complete Chick Webb and Ella Fitzgerald Decca Sessions, 1934 through 1941, on the Mosaic label. Coming up, actor Michael Sheen tells us about starring in the Showtime series Masters of Sex. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies, in for Terry Gross.
Why would a woman fake an orgasm?
Usually so the woman could get back to whatever it is she'd rather be doing.
Our next guest, British actor Michael Sheen, is currently starring in the Showtime series Masters of Sex, in which he plays the groundbreaking sex researcher William Masters. Some of Sheen's most memorable roles have been playing real people. He was a highly regarded theater actor in England, where he played Mozart and Caligula, among others. He got into movies and earned good reviews, playing Prime Minister Tony Blair in The Queen and two other films. And he played the late British journalist David Frost in the stage and screen versions of Frost Nixon. When I spoke to Michael Sheen, we began with the new Showtime series Masters of Sex, about the collaboration between Dr. William Masters and his associate Virginia Johnson. Starting in the 1950s, they researched the physiological impact of sex by observing men and women having intercourse with electrodes attached to capture physical changes. In this scene, Masters and Johnson have decided to participate in the study by having sex with each other. And beforehand, they're asking each other the background questions every participant has to answer. Johnson, played by Lizzie Kaplan, speaks first.
I was 15.
Where did it take place?
In the back of a Plymouth. And how old were you when you first had sexual intercourse?
20. In a cabin on Rainbow Lake.
Did you have sexual intercourse with your spouse before marriage?
I did not. Did you?
Yes, with both marriages.
I suppose it never occurred to me to wait until marriage. If currently married, how frequently do you have coitus with your spouse?
We're not having coitus presently.
Because of the miscarriage, I should have skipped that question.
That's all right. How frequently do you have coitus with a partner?
I don't have a partner at present.
Meaning you're not having coitus?
Meaning no, not right now. Last question before we start. Does emotional attachment play a significant role in your ability to enjoy sex?
Significant role? Hard to say, but yes, I suppose so. A qualified yes. And you?
Not really. I mean, it can, but it's a curious thing. I've always felt different from other women. Most women, they want love when they sleep with a man. I've always been able to separate sex from love.
And that's our guest, Michael Sheen, and Lizzie Kaplan in the Showtime series Masters of Sex. Well, Michael Sheen, welcome to Fresh Air. So much is going on there as we listen to your voice. I mean, this guy is detached. He's threatened. He's trying to be honest. It's also kind of the kind of conversation people have before they're about to become physically intimate, which is, you know, kind of fraught with tension anyway.
Yes, exactly. I mean, incredibly vulnerable and exposing and intimate. And that's a big part of what the show is about. You know, I think the thing that makes people's ears prick up is that it's a show about sex and a study about sex. But it's, you know, ultimately it's a study of intimacy, of how do we deal with being vulnerable.
Yeah. Well, I guess what I find fascinating when I remember these scenes where you and Lizzie Kaplan are looking at each other and you're supposed to be these two professionals engaging in an act of research, but in fact you're engaging in this very intimate act of physical intercourse, and there are moments where you're looking into each other's eyes, and I see this like, am I going to express love here? I start to, and then I catch myself because no, I can't be doing that. This is all about science.
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, specifically scenes where, for instance, like you're describing, where we are having sex, but because the whole idea is that it's separate of emotion and attraction and all those kind of things, that it's just scientific. You know, of course it can't be. It's impossible for it to be like that. But you have these two people, or certainly this one person, Bill Masters, who is, you know, leading the experiment and trying not to show any emotion. And that is a very peculiar thing to play as an actor, to be doing something that is usually in a story the most intimate thing, where you're, you know, you see desire, you see lust, you see attraction, you see all those things, you're kissing or whatever, and that sort of makes it easy. You lose yourself in it. And here's a scene where we're not even supposed to look at each other particularly as it's happening, and I'm supposed to say orgasm as I orgasm, or plateau or whatever it might be. And that is a very peculiar thing to act, but it's sort of brilliant, you know, it's a wonderful thing to act rather than the sort of usual boring way. Regular sex will always be just boring for me now.
We're speaking with Michael Sheen. He stars in the new Showtime series, Masters of Sex. I'd like to talk about The Queen, the 2006 film that you were in, with directed by Stephen Frears. in which you played Prime Minister Tony Blair, and this is one of three films in which you've played Tony Blair. This is the middle of the three. I guess there's a particular challenge to playing a real person who's still around and whom the audience has very clear images of.
Yes. I mean, it's a lot of it, apart from anything else, is about expectations and people's own personal feelings about that person. When it's a politician and a very controversial political figure, then how people feel about him personally clearly plays into how they're going to react to what you're doing in the film. So that's, you know, a huge challenge.
Well, let's hear a clip from the film. This is, you know, it's about Queen Elizabeth and the royal family's reaction to the untimely death of Princess Diana when Tony Blair was, I guess, relatively recently elected prime minister. And the problem was the Queen was very remote and appeared to be uncaring to a grieving public since Princess Diana was no longer a part of the royal family. And the result was horrifically negative media coverage, popular anger at the Queen and even at the monarchy itself. And Prime Minister Blair, you know, spends a lot of the film trying to advise the Queen to come to London, make a public statement, show some sympathy, which eventually she does, and that gesture is well received. And the scene we're going to hear is near the end of the film, months after that drama, when the Prime Minister has his regular meeting with the Queen. She's played by Helen Mirren. And in this meeting, you refer back to that tumultuous week that you experienced.
The circumstances were exceptional, ma'am. And in the end, you showed great personal strength, courage, and humility.
You're confusing humility with humiliation.
That's not true.
You didn't read the cards or the flowers outside the palace that Friday.
I actually think history will show it was a good week for you.
And an even better one for you, Mr. Blair.
But there are 52 weeks in the year, ma'am, and 2,500 in the time since you've been queen. And when people come to assess your legacy, they won't remember those few days.
Oh, really? You don't think that what affection people once had for this institution has been diminished?
No, not at all. You're more respected now than ever.
I gather some of your closest advisers were less fulsome in their support.
One or two. But as a leader, I could never have added my voice to that chorus.
Because you saw those headlines and you thought one day that might happen to me.
Oh.
And it will, Mr. Blair. Quite suddenly and without warning.
And that is Helen Mirren as Queen Elizabeth and our guest Michael Sheen in the film The Queen. You know, since you played Tony Blair so much and so well, did you ever talk to him about your performances?
I tend to, on the rare occasions when I played characters who are actually still alive, and there is the possibility, I suppose, of meeting them, I have always shied away from that. Certainly until a point where I feel confident in where I'm going with the character or what my take is, at least. Because I don't want to be thrown off. I don't want to feel compromised in how I approach the characters. And if you actually know the person, then that can be a bit difficult. With Blair, in between the Queen and Special Relationship, where I felt like I sort of knew what I was doing a bit more, there was the opportunity came up to meet him, and so I did, and it was very interesting. I knew that he had said that he'd never watched any of the films, which I think, from a political point of view, was the most appropriate response, because if he says he's seen them, then obviously people can say, well, is that true, and did that happen, and did that happen, and, you know, I'm sure he doesn't want to get into those sort of conversations. So he certainly possessed a very good working knowledge of scenes from all three, or all two at that point. And in fact, when I was doing the research, it was very interesting over the course of the three that as I did research in between for each one and preparation for each one, I would obviously look at any new footage that had come out since the last one. And in doing the preparation for Special Relationship, the third one, of course, in the documentaries, which there had been a lot made because Blair had, you know, was no longer Prime Minister. And so there was a lot of, you know, his legacy and the overall thing. Obviously, the films like The Deal and The Queen became part of those documentaries. So my research included my own performance, which was very peculiar.
But so when when you met. There was no pat on the shoulder, no attaboy, no you didn't get this quite right, none of that.
Oh, goodness me, no. There was certainly no attaboy. It was a very kind of, it was like two dogs sniffing each other a little bit. He was very qualified in his kind of reaction. He's someone who clearly is very charming and is very easy to like and warm to when you meet them as a human being. But I could see that his sort of sensors were kind of going haywire, where he sort of wants to be lovely and nice to me, but also doesn't want to give anything away just in case I use it and all that kind of stuff. So it was very strange. And then essentially he put his chief of staff and the lady who ran his foundation on me, and they kept me away from him all night.
Well, I wanted to talk about the film The Damned United, 2009 film directed by Tom Hooper. I just love this film, and I want to bring it up in partly so more American audiences will find it. It's about a British soccer figure. Explain to us who your character Brian Clough was. He's a real guy.
Mm. Well, when I was growing up, Brian Clough was one of the biggest larger-than-life characters in the whole of British culture. He was a soccer manager, or coach, I think people would refer to him as over here. He, a number of times, worked with teams that were languishing at the bottom of the very minor divisions, and through sheer force of personality on the whole, would lead them into becoming championship-winning teams. And he had such an extraordinary personality and was so unpredictable and so controversial and did such extraordinary things and had such massive contradictions within his character that he exerted this kind of influence over a group of men, where he became almost like a religious deity. And the problem within our story comes when the other soccer coach, who's the biggest soccer coach in Britain at the time with the most successful team, a man called Don Revie, leading a team called Leeds United, Clough has said such awful things about him and awful things about his team, who are the main team. And then Clough gets offered the job of being the manager of that team after Don Revie leaves.
Well, let me break in right there, because that's the clip that we have where you have just taken the job, you as Brian Clough, as the manager of Leeds United, having proved yourself a remarkable manager, a coach elsewhere, and now you're taking over this group of stars who've had championships in their past. And let's listen to your first discussion with the players.
You lot may all be internationals and have won all the domestic honours there are to win under Don Revie. But as far as I'm concerned, the first thing you can do for me is to chuck all your medals and all your caps and all your pots and all your pans into the biggest dustbin you can find, because you've never won any of them fairly. You've done it all by bloody cheating. Mr. William Bremner, you're the captain, and a good one. But you're no good to the team, and you're no good to me, if you're suspended. I want you fit for every game, and I want good, clean, attractive football from my captain, starting next week at the Charity Shield. And you, Irishman, God gave you skill, intelligence and the best passing ability in the game. What God did not give you was six studs to wrap around another player's knee. Now, things are going to be a little different around here without Don. Might feel a little strange at first, might pinch a little like a new pair of shoes. But if you want your grandchildren to remember you as being something other than the dirty buggers you once were, if you want to be loved as real champions, worthy champions, you're going to have to work and improve and change.
Hello, coach. I just love that scene. That is our guest, Michael Sheen, in the film The Damned United. You know, I know from reading about you that you were quite the soccer player as a young man. In fact, at age 12, you had a shot at going to a professional team, and your dad said, no, we're not going to move to London, so you can do that. And you went into acting, obviously, had great success at it. But you clearly were an athlete when you were younger, and there is a moment in this film, near this one, where you're standing in front of the new players at Leeds, and you do a little soccer stuff. Will you tell us about filming that and the moves that you put on?
Yeah, well, it's true. I was that was my obsession, was soccer when I was growing up, so I did a lot of it. And then, of course, when I started to get a modicum of success as an actor, everyone would always ask about it. And I suppose in some ways made the mistake of saying that I was offered a place at a professional team. And so this became part of, you know, the publicity about me. So then when I actually came to do a film about a soccer player, of course everyone was just waiting to watch whether I could actually do it or not. And so the day that we did that scene that we heard the clip from, after he does that speech and he's just, you know, made these men just so angry at him, and he's so cocky and he's so full of himself, and at the end of it he just he gets one of the players to kick the ball over to him, and he sort of does keepy up, where you sort of keep volleying it and keeping it up on your head and your knee and your shoulders and all that kind of stuff, and then turns around and then kicks it and hits it into the top of the net. That's in the script. So the day we shot that film, the pressure was enormous. I couldn't believe it. I thought, this is where it's all going to come tumbling down and people are going to go, you're a liar, you're never any good. First take, back of the net. Oh, yes. And it's there as evidence on those film cameras.
I know that you grew up in Wales, a town called Port Talbot. Tell us a bit about growing up in Port Talbot. It was a coastal city in Wales. Tell us about what kind of childhood you had.
Well, it's not a city. It's a town. It has sort of between, I guess, about 35,000, 40,000 people. It's on the coast, yes. It's an old steel town. It's sort of built up around a steelworks. And there was also a chemical plant there for a long time growing up. So the town itself is known in the area, really, for being sort of a joke. It was the dirty, sort of industrial, smelly place in amongst quite beautiful rural areas on either side. So growing up in the town, it was a town that had very low self-esteem. There was high unemployment. Once the people started getting laid off at the steelworks, the chemical plant closed down. It's a working-class town. It was quite rough. I grew up in a sort of atmosphere of latent violence most of the time. But it was a place that, you know, my family had grown up in and come from for generations. And I sort of, I don't know, it sort of instilled a passionate love of this place. And partly an aesthetic as well. I found out years and years later that a hero of mine, Terry Gilliam, got the idea for the film Brazil from actually being on the beach in Port Talbot. He told me that he was scouting for another film that he did, Time Bandits, which he shot some of in Wales. But when he was scouting for it and he went down onto the beach, he was sitting there on the beach in a deck chair with a steelworks on one side with flames coming out and huge monstrous kind of metal cylinders and things. And then on the other side of him, this chemical plant with orange smoke belching out of cooling towers, and he said in his head he just heard dun 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 dun, and that was when he got the idea for Brazil.
Wow.
So you get a sense of what the place looks like from that, really.
Michael Sheen, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Michael Sheen stars in the Showtime series Masters of Sex. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our assistant producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.